This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So what we do know is that they have very limited local support. The fact that we've seen a surge in violence doesn't indicate necessarily that there is a large local support within local communities for these groups.
That's Daniel Azenga from the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on extremists carrying out attacks in the Sahel region. Details coming up. Also, there is a political crisis brewing in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau, and emergency assistance is starting to pour in into Somalia to help hundreds of thousands driven from their homes by severe flooding. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, there is a political crisis brewing in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau. Reports indicate that the UN Security Council joined regional voices and yesterday called for restraint and dialogue. To better understand the crisis, we have in studio Alvaro Andrade, managing editor of the VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Alvaro.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Alvaro, give us a little background regarding the crisis brewing in Guinea-Bissau.
Yeah, Guinea-Bissau in the last 20 years, there is a more than no one government finishes mandate, his term in Guinea-Bissau, in the last, since 1998. Guinea-Bissau suffering a lot of coup of state. The last was in 2012. And now they experience a very difficult crisis after 4 years with seven governments, one president and seven governments in 4 years. Aristides Gomes, prime minister, was inaugurated in after March parliamentary election, and he won the election. PAIGC is his party. But the PAIGC has other candidate, Domingos Simões Pereira. And the president, his candidate also in the presidential election in November 24. After that, they start dealing about drug trafficking, about corruption. And then 2 weeks ago, the president fired the prime minister. 1 week after the government, the parliament approved the government program for the next 4 years. What suddenly the president dismissed the government, he says, for lack of confidence. But the entire international community condemned the decision of the president, who inaugurated a new government but did not start working yet. Now, Guinea-Bissau has two governments. The former prime minister is in charge and he's working in all the ministry. And the new prime minister is working in the home, in the party headquarters.
So that is the tension that's going on?
No, and same time, the presidential campaign started last Saturday. Now you have now two prime ministers, two governments, and one presidential campaign.
For November 24th.
Don't forget, in Guinea-Bissau, the power is with the prime minister, not with the president. It's like Israel, like in Europe, the president is it's a referee, not the executive branch.
Like a figurehead.
Like a figure, yes.
Yes.
But the who runs the country is the prime minister. And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And then what happened yesterday, the U.S. ambassador in Bissau, Tulinabo Musinji, on behalf of representative international community, they met the Prime Minister Aristides Gomes and they expressed support for the government of Aristides Gomes. And yesterday, like you said before, the UN support, the ECOWAS and the African Union who support the Prime Minister Aristides Gomes. And This situation is very difficult because Guinea-Bissau has a long story of coup of state, and we don't know have what's going on after the election. The army is in the barracks. In the barracks. They said this is the political issue, it's not a military issue, it's not a security issue of our country. Let's see what's going to happen in the next three weeks.
But you're very right. Guinea-Bissau has a history of instability since becoming independence in 1974.
Yeah.
So now there's a stalemate. What is the solution to what's going on right now? We have, like you mentioned, two prime ministers, one president, election coming up.
I think if the military stay in the headquarters, maybe they're going to elect a new president. Maybe is the president the candidate from the PAGC who held the government now. Maybe they can get the stability because the ECOWAS has more than 400 troops in Bissau. You know, I believe the solution is in the army solution. Okay, the army is going to stay in the headquarters, and then the politics is gonna solve the problem through the election, through the new president with the new government. Maybe they're still with the same government because the PAGC is the majority party in Bissau.
So ECOWAS has a little power
now,
going on.
Now the president...
Could they also impose like sanctions?
Yes, they already had a sanction. 19
already in place.
Already in place. 19, and I received information 2 minutes before I came here. The UN still held the sanction against 12 militaries who imposed the sanction in 2012. Maybe when UN has 12 Guinean military with in sanction and 19 politics. The politician Guinness with sanction by ECOWAS means, I think the ECOWAS and UN they are doing a good job in Guinea-Bissau to maintain some stability until the next 20 days.
ECOWAS could be the final solution.
Yeah.
Managing editor from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, Alvaro Andrade. Thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
Emergency assistance is starting to pour into Somalia, where hundreds of thousands have been driven from their homes by severe flooding. Lisa Schlein has the latest from Geneva.
More than 300,000 people have been made homeless by some of the worst flooding experienced by Somalia in years. Parts of the country, especially in the central Somali district of Beledweyne, have been devastated. Aid agencies are responding with increasing speed. For example, the World Food Program has distributed ready-to-eat food and high-energy biscuits to thousands of the displaced. The UN Migration Agency has delivered more than 3,200 non-food supply kits containing blankets, mattresses, and kitchen sets. The UN Refugee Agency this week delivered humanitarian supplies in the first of a series of flights organized to help more than 20,000 people cut off by the flooding. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says up to 10 flights, 3 a day, are scheduled to airlift 60 metric tons of supplies.
The air operation largely depends on landing strips being available as floodwaters have engulfed a vast area. Reports of our partners indicate that villages on the outskirts of Beledweyne, which is about 340 kilometers north of capital Mogadishu, have been submerged and hundreds of families are trapped in their homes.
In the meantime, the World Health Organization warns many flood-hit districts have become cholera hotspots, with few healthcare facilities available to treat the sick. It says there also has been an upsurge of malaria and diarrhea. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevic tells VOA the floods give rise to other health issues.
One of them is obviously it's injuries. People get injured. There's a risk of drowning. There is a risk of being cut just walking through the water, stepping on nails or on glass. And then there is also issue of access to health services because the health facilities become difficult to reach.
UN officials warn disasters such as the Somali floods highlight the increasing vulnerabilities of people in this country and others to the effects of global warming and climate change. They note this latest calamity was preceded by a severe drought in July. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In recent months, there has been a steady increase in violent attacks by militant extremists in Mali and elsewhere in Africa's Sahel region. In just the past several days, more than 50 soldiers from Mali and one French soldier have died in attacks. Daniel Izenga is a research fellow studying violent extremism in the Sahel at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the characteristics of the increased violence.
It's challenging to identify any single cause for the rise in militant activity that we've seen in the last several months. I'd point out that, you know, the surges have happened at different times in different regions throughout the Sahel. So central Mali has seen surges in the past. Most recent attacks have taken place in northern Mali, but also in northern Burkina Faso, in an area where there are borders between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. I think important and worth noting that with this increased violence, we've also seen larger losses on the part of national armed forces. And so most recent attacks over this past weekend, we're seeing dozens of Malian soldiers who were killed. And not long ago, I think it was in August, we saw the deadliest loss of life for the Burkinabe armed forces. That suggests that these violent extremist groups have fairly decent intelligence, that they're able to monitor the armed forces, their movements, and they're working to try and catch them off guard. So part of why I think we're seeing this surge in violence is really related to the ability of violent extremist groups to gather useful intelligence on national armed forces, to continue to take advantage of these moments to collect arms and gather equipment. Because they're operating in this border area where you have borders shared between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, they're able to exploit those borders to move around and thereby evading different patrols and missions that are being led by the national armed forces and other actors in the region.
Well, you mentioned the idea that the militant forces have improved their intelligence gathering as well as the stockpile of weapons they have to use. Does that indicate that they are getting funding or support or arms from other groups around the continent?
That's a really important question, and it's one that we haven't been able to really answer so far. The information coming in and the intelligence that we've been able to gather is very fluid, and so it's very challenging to get a good sense of where support is coming from for these groups. What we do know is that they have very limited local support, and so the fact that we've seen a surge in violence doesn't indicate necessarily that there is a large local support within local communities for these groups. In fact, some of what we've seen in the last several months indicates that there's not much local support for these groups, as they've, in addition to targeting state forces, the armed forces, they've also targeted political leaders and communities. And so that suggests that these groups feel that political leaders in the different local communities are a challenge to their authority. And so they've been targeting them and assassinating them. A recent example this past weekend, the mayor of Djibo, which is the main urban center in a part of northern Burkina Faso, was assassinated after speaking out against these groups for several months. Just really want to highlight that point that the local support for these violent extremist groups is very low.
There is the Sahel 5 force that is partly funded by the U.S., France, others, to build security in the region. What can these forces do, the Sahel 5? You know, what can the governments in the region do, and what can the Western allies who are working with them do?
Sure. Well, I think what's really needed and probably the most important thing is a sustained security presence in these regions. So it's important to note that northern Burkina Faso, northern Mali, western Niger, where we've seen this most recent surge of violence, these tend to be marginalized areas that are hard to access. They don't have a long history of infrastructure or other forms of development that would allow for the state and armed forces to assert its presence. And so coming up with a short, medium, and long-term plan for how to sustain a security presence across this area is going to be central to confronting the challenge of violent extremist organizations there.
That was Daniel Aizenga, research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty-one past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. There is a political crisis brewing in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau. Emergency assistance is starting to pour into Somalia to help hundreds of thousands driven from their homes by severe flooding. And their studies indicate there is a steady increase in violent attacks by militant extremists in the Sahel region. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. South Africa's decisive victory over England in the Rugby World Cup final made history as the Springboks were led by a black captain for the first time. 20-year-old Siya Kolisi rose to the peak of sports long associated with South Africa's white minority. Rugby fans who watched the final Saturday say the win is even sweeter because it represents a real breakthrough in this nation's bitter racial divide. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The victory Saturday by South Africa's rugby team was momentous, in more ways than one. The championship was the third world title for the Springboks, but the first time the team was led by a black captain, Siya Kolisi. His is an inspiring tale of triumph over the odds, from childhood in a poor black township to the head of South African rugby, traditionally a white-dominated sport. Longtime rugby fan Tando Makasi comes from Kolisi's hometown, Zwide. After watching the game at a Johannesburg bar Saturday, she says his life and leading the Springboks to victory are an inspiration.
I think it's a win overall. I think this tournament has just brought so much hope. I mean, South Africa, the year has been going, the change in presidency, the elections, and we come to this point where we really are rallying behind the box and we're one together, strong together, stronger together.
The win, many fans say, is reminiscent of the nation's 1995 Rugby World Cup triumph, when South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, embraced the sport. South Africa ended the racist apartheid system in 1994. The next year, with racial tensions still fresh, Mandela walked onto the pitch, wearing a green and gold Springboks jersey to congratulate team captain Francois Pienaar. Their warm embrace showed this divided nation was on a path to racial reconciliation. In the crowds of rugby fans in Johannesburg, Nigel Ngwenya stands out. And not just because he plays rugby for the University of the Witwatersrand and weighs a solid 120 kilograms. Ngwenya is an England fan and wore their red jersey. But he gives the Springboks and Captain Kolisi their due.
They have that fighting spirit. They've got that never give up, never die spirit. Whatever you bring to the table, they try to catch up and actually do better, which they've been doing in the past games. Siya Kolisi, oh man. Guys coming from far. It's amazing. It's a shame I'm not supporting. I would have preferred him to play for England. But
28-year-old Springboks fan Madi Ramahuma says rugby is more than just a game of kicks and passes. It's about the soul of this nation.
South Africa is not about color. Well, since 1994, we are just trying. Eventually, we're getting there just to be South Africans. But one thing I love about sports, it always brings us all together. It doesn't matter where you're from, what you have, what you don't have. It's sports.
By the final whistle and a 32-12 victory for South Africa, even Ngwenya, the England supporter, was a changed fan, swapping his red jersey for Springbok green. It was only 80 minutes of play, but a new chapter in the Rainbow Nation's continuing story of hope and reconciliation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Dubai-based Amara Group launched what it calls Africa's first smartphone manufacturer last month in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Mara Phone says it offers the first high-quality, affordable smartphone made in Africa to compete in a market dominated by South Korean and Chinese brands. As Ruth Almandrop reports from Kigali, customers are starting to notice the African phone brand.
We're in the store of Mara Phone in Kigali. The interior is stylishly decorated with shiny Mara phones in sparkling displays. Even more remarkable is the absence of any common brands from China or South Korea. In fact, the store doesn't carry any foreign brands because Mara Phone is the first smartphone to be made in Rwanda and the whole of Africa. The Dubai-based Mara Group in October opened their first Mara Phone factory in Kigali. Rwandese and Indian staff work with a 27-meter assembly line to manufacture the tiny phone motherboards. Abhishek Garg is the production manager.
Here we are manufacturing the complete smartphone, which includes the motherboard, subboard, the assembly of the complete parts. So all together we bring together the 1,000 parts of the mobile phones together to convert it into a smartphone.
The Mara phone is marketed as the first high-quality, affordable smartphone made in Rwanda. And the African branding seems to be working. Samson Adote comes from Ghana and he's dressed in the latest fashion.
As an African, I feel proud to know, see and experience this, particularly because it sort of shows what is possible within Africa and it's beautiful.
So far, Mara Phone has produced 30,000 smartphones in Rwanda, a country picked because of its more business-friendly rules and tax incentives. Rwanda says hosting the first made-in-Africa smartphone is another step toward becoming a regional technology and innovation hub. But they are entering a market dominated by Chinese and South Korean brands and struggling against poor infrastructure. Logistics is the biggest issue, according to Managing Director Eddie Sabera.
The biggest challenge we have at the moment is obviously getting the raw materials. Supply chain is pretty slow sometimes. This is something that we can't control because it depends on cargo airlines here and there. So that is an external factor that we can't control.
But the phone manufacturer is confident there's room in the market for the first made-in-Africa smartphone. Mara Phone plans to extend its production capacity to roll out across the African continent and eventually the world. Ruth Almendorp for VOA News, Kigali.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.